Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for October 18th, 2009. I'm your host, Command Line, the self-proclaimed hacker, curmudgeon, and hacktivist, and this is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing from over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of society and politics with technology, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast in it. Larry Lessig takes on the notion of naked transparency, an ultimate limit for the speed of computation and Moore's Law, how safe really are Facebook apps, and the ACTA negotiations are now back underway, with some folks able to actually see them, but only under a tight non-disclosure agreement. All of this and more. First, though, I wanted to share my initial impressions with Google's Wave. This is the much-touted and anticipated service that was demoed at a Google conference some months ago. Folks are just now starting to get invites into the preview version of the service. This is the second iteration, as I understand it. The first was more of a developer sandbox. The two servers, and actually the pieces parts, the gadgets and bots developed for the original sandbox are not actually compatible in many cases with the preview. They need to be updated or altered in some way to work with the preview. I will admit to the same initial confusion that a lot of folks felt. I additionally had some trouble with the fact that I use Google Apps mostly for my Gmail and my contacts being bound up in that particular silo and not available to my new Wave account. However, once I figured out how to export and re-import that into my standard Google account, I discovered a lot of other folks that I know that are on Wave, and I found that the only place where I was actually getting any kind of real use out of it was when I started up some public Waves for discussion, in particular one for the show itself, and if you're on Wave, you can do a /public search for the Command Line Podcast. You'll actually find that Wave. And another for the DC area copy night, where some of the regulars actually were signed on and contributing links for the upcoming discussion in just over a week. If you want to find me and include me in any of your experimentation with Wave, you can do so by adding cmdln.net at googlewave.com into your contacts, and I should show up also. I think my primary email address, cmdln@thecommandline.net, should also work. I think that's mapped correctly into my Google account, and it should recognize that and add me as a valid Wave contact. Really, outside of those group collaborations, though, I'm kind of struggling with it. It is not the social messaging aggregator that I thought it might be. I have gotten the Tweety bot. That's the bot that integrates Twitter into Google Wave up and running. But I don't find that experience any more compelling than using the Twitter service in and of itself or any other microblog service in and of itself or with third parties. I actually find many of the third parties for StatusNet and Identica and Twitter to be much better realized and more fully developed. It's possible that the bot for Google Wave could catch up with these. I just don't think that there's anything like I initially predicted inherent in Wave itself that makes it better at aggregating these sorts of things, other than perhaps developer interest for more developers to develop those kinds of pluggable components. So it might be easier just from a pure mechanical perspective to pull those information streams together. I, like many others, am still also kind of just struggling beyond that sort of group collaboration to see what, if any, value there is there. That being said, if you are in the habit of regularly working with a group online and you want a kind of a backbone for communication that works both well synchronously and asynchronously, it leaves the kind of accumulated knowledge from the conversation in place, can be edited like a wiki and is very amorphous, then you may find Google Wave to have a lot of potential to support those sorts of interactions. I think, unfortunately, it's very difficult in terms of usability for simpler applications, like using it as an email replacement or an IM replacement. So I think the cost to use it for these pre-existing services that are already very well established and well streamlined is a bit prohibitive, but your mileage may vary. And as always, if you are on Wave, I would welcome not only that you contact me, but also if you want to send a bit of feedback to the show to give me your impressions as well. If you've found any particular novel or interesting uses that I might be missing, I'd be happy to hear about them and give them a try. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. The first alert I have is a read-write web piece that actually digs into some work being done by a couple of different researchers on this question of how safe from a security perspective are Facebook apps. I've actually entered into discussions in the past of some of the privacy implications around Facebook apps, most notably the ACLU chapter's quiz to reveal just how much information even a simple quiz app has access to with very little oversight or control from the main platform. In this piece, AVG, a known security firm, has uncovered some of the first evidence of actually exploited or hacked apps on the Facebook platform. Rather than, as has been common in the past, like with the Kubeface worm, hacking other aspects of that social network site. The compromised apps have, in this instance, what's detailed in the article, a very small install base, so the risk here is rather small versus the much larger general population on Facebook. But another researcher actually found some hacked applications, according to the article, in the actual current top 10 most popular apps for Facebook. The apps found by AVG in particular were hacked via malware actually on the developer's PC, so it doesn't appear to be a case where they maliciously added these sorts of attacks. In this case, what AVG found were iframes that were added by this third-party malware that then caused the apps when loaded into your profile to access content from malicious sites. The article also talks about the more general research being undertaken by a fellow going by the moniker The Harmony Guy, investigating what are now becoming known as fax hacks, F-A-X-X, that's Facebook plus XSS plus XSRF, that's cross-site scripting and cross-site request forgery, respectively. He found few, if any, applications that actually actively secured against either cross-site scripting or cross-site request forgery. Many non-secure apps have even passed through Facebook's own verified app program, which apparently doesn't do any kind of realistic or practical security audits of the app code. The Harmony Guy contacted many, if not all, of the app developers directly, and most of them actually responded to do what they could to correct the very specific issues that he identified. The article emphasizes the facts research has just uncovered vulnerable applications versus the AVG research that actually revealed compromised applications. So the exploited applications on the platform do still seem to be very much in the minority. The problem is that it points out that even the vulnerable research points out the utter lack of security mechanisms in Facebook's third-party app platform. Personally, I don't find these apps to be very useful for social messaging and social networking, and I'd really recommend that you fall much more strongly on the side against using them when running that sort of social utility calculus, at least until the site itself responds to some of this research by improving some of the basic security, maybe implementing some sort of a sandbox around these apps themselves. The other alert I have is an explanation of how Microsoft's actions in the past have actually exposed Firefox users to drive-by attacks. This is actually a continuation of what was originally not strictly a security story, although it had security implications. That was news a while back of a Microsoft update installing an extension into Firefox without the knowledge or consent of end users. It was some sort of a framework plugin, the .NET framework assistant that got installed with a particular version of a Visual Studio or update to that, I believe, or to the .NET kind of tooling and runtime. It now turns out that there's an exploitable vulnerability in that framework assistant. It has, as far as I can tell from the Microsoft advisory cited by the zero-day piece I've linked to, it has been addressed by a patch from Microsoft, though the explanation in their advisory is kind of unclear what the ramifications are for Firefox users that had this extension installed without their knowledge. It actually makes it sound like, and I'm not sure this is right, that Firefox users may still be vulnerable even if the actual Windows operating system and the libraries that did the installation of this add-on themselves are patched no longer vulnerable. Microsoft security folks, regardless, are recommending disabling the extension under Firefox. I'd say if you can, follow the directions up to the point where they say to click on the disable button in the add-ons preferences for Firefox. And if you can, try to uninstall it. The .NET framework now, as a follow-on from this, the framework assistant is being blocked by Mozilla with their block list. It turns out that many users actually have had problems uninstalling it. It may not be possible for you to manually uninstall it. And so Mozilla has gone a step further in order to protect their install base by adding this add-on to their block list. This is a feature of the browser through central management that allows them to block listed add-ons from being installed, ones that are verified to be problematic or untrustworthy, and it actually will disable them in browsers where they already have been installed. Regardless, if you're running Firefox on Windows, you're probably going to want to check in your add-ons under the preferences to see if this particular extension is there and to verify its state is disabled. Take that extra step if you need to, if for some reason Mozilla's block list didn't reach you and disable the extension for you. Mozilla actually, according to the posting on their security blog, contacted Microsoft before they added the entry to their block list, and Redmond Giant, surprisingly, agreed with their decision to block the add-on. So everybody seems to be on the same page in terms of this is a verified vulnerability, and the safest course is to get rid of or otherwise defang this Microsoft add-on. Here are the news that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website, thecommandline.net. Professor Lawrence Lessig had a very provocative piece in The New Republic this past week that many folks picked up and remarked upon. His contention in this is that transparency in and of itself is not really a value. And this has set off a lot of folks who are big proponents for open government and transparency in government. And I think there's been a lot of misperceptions about what it is that Lessig is actually saying in this piece. So I've got a very quick summary I'll try to run down to better clarify the argument to the point where hopefully you will take the time your own self, if you're interested, to read this very lengthy and I think ultimately very well thought out piece. He's concerned that a push to maximum openness may actually do more harm than good. He's not necessarily against transparency itself per se. He seems to be calling for more thought around the movement towards transparency and allows that its use in management data may be inherently good, providing insight and accountability on executive decisions, for instance, and projects that are really whose reason for being seems to be about the production of data like the National Weather Service, the GPS system, and mapping from the U.S. Topological Survey and the like. His real question is about opening data on influences, which makes a certain amount of sense given his recent focus with Change Congress, looking at how campaign contributions and lobbying efforts, the effect of money on decision-making in Congress may be skewing and adding subtle forms of corruption and bias. And it's not just lobbying and campaign money for legislators that he talks about. He provides a couple of examples of what he means by this, talking about a healthcare reform bill that would institute some proposed disclosures for doctors as part of the healthcare bill. This would seem to be on the surface a good revealing money from big pharma, from device makers and speaking gigs. He also gives an example where it seems this sort of transparency about influences actually does a pretty good job, does what we would expect, actually working to reveal how a climate and energy bill was weakened and in places even gutted. He does a pretty good job of framing the discussion too historically based on the work of Brandeis, who was a lawyer ultimately, then a Louis Brandeis, ultimately a Supreme Court justice, and his work towards transparency and openness. He coined that saw about sunlight being the most effective form of disinfectant, and he does a pretty good job of explaining what it is that Brandeis actually espouse, that is targeted transparency, providing data that was comprehensible enough that the average citizen or consumer could act or decide upon it rationally and regulate the market as individual actors on that basis, rather than using other regulatory mechanisms that seek to directly influence the market. He actually also points to a later book on that subject of Brandeis and sort of this historical context that digs into this idea by Fung and others that contends more data is not necessarily always better. Brandeis, after all, also said that the remedy to problems of speech is more speech, and this would seem to unpack some of the latent ambiguities in that notion, that seemingly on the surface a very good idea. Information has to be understood in the context into which it is being published. Simply put, Lessig thinks that the naked transparency movement really misses this point. It has failed to consider the context of this information and the decision-making that hinges upon that context, how it realistically can be evaluated and used by the target audience, whether it will have the desired effect in helping regulation by the masses. He lays out and actually attempts to substantiate further problems. For one, the problem of correlation and causation that comes up whenever we talk about any kind of massive unqualified data, that they are not one and the same, but that people fall trapped to biases of thinking that a correlation in the data speaks to an actual cause. He also talks about, in the article, attention span being a limiter on analysis, assuming that every citizen will repeat the work of every other rather than build on it. And I think in some ways he formulates a pretty reasonable case on some of the barriers to making effective use of naked transparency, though I think this is also the part of the article where he is most wrong. Not in how every person actually ultimately parses out facts for themselves, but the fact that every citizen would need to do so. I think it's more likely that we'll have self-selected public analysts filling some of this gap, simplifying data so that everyone else can make decisions based on it. It's comparable to what I think journalists do in an ideal world, acting as acting out the role that they have been charged with by many in a free and open democracy. The problem is you cannot really free data for just a class of people, the constituents of whom you don't know. Who they're going to be, you can't predict, and over time they may change. So the risk is that freeing the data for anyone and inviting the problems of having anybody coming in versus lowering those barriers for those that will do informed analysis and will try to build the sort of context that he thinks is necessary. It's a question of access, and I don't know, you know, I think he neatly sidesteps it and doesn't enter into that issue, and I think that is an opportunity missed in the discussion. I think setting that aside, though, he does frame a valid problem of unintended consequences and the loss of control ultimately caused by the network being added into this availability of data. His ultimate answer is to use transparency to eliminate false insinuations. He mentions a public campaign funding to eliminate possibly wrong motivators to just take out any sort of correlations that people may mistake for causative influences. He even manages to tie his suggestion into proposals around flat fee licensing or voluntary collective licensing for music that the EFF and other folks in the copyright debate have advanced. I think while this piece is very, very provocative, and I don't think it's entirely right in all of its respects, I pointed out the biggest problem I had with it, I do think, as I said at the outset, it is very well reasoned. And what it does that I think a lot of good academic work tries to do, regardless of how it's received and the criticisms that ultimately are heaped upon it, is it tries to build a framework to think about the problem, whether you agree with it or not. Unfortunately, it is a very long piece, and I think actually the attention span problem that he talks about in the piece itself, ironically, may limit people's understanding, may limit their ability to parse through this for themselves. I highly encourage that if anything I've talked about here sparks your interest, that you do set aside the time, read and try to understand this piece for yourself. I've included a link in the show notes, too, to Carl Malamud's response to this on the O'Reilly Radar site. If you don't have the time to read Lessig's piece or The Inclination, I would encourage you to actually read Carl's. It's much shorter, more accessible, and I think he actually does a really good job of pulling out Lessig's main point and then goes on to augment it from his own experience. And he does so overall in a very constructive way. There are also, if you do have the will and the time to read through not only Lessig's piece, but also Malamud's response, as the New Republic also has published a handful of responses as well from the likes of David Weinberger, Tim Wu, and others. And I'll include a link to the first response, which has links to the others as well, in the show notes. This next piece is another thought-provoking one, but it's much more lighthearted, I promise. And that is a piece that Charlie Strauss posted up on his blog about why it is that he doesn't like Star Trek. One of the things that I enjoyed most about the Laundry series, the Bob Howard books by Strauss, are the very thoughtful afterwards that he includes with them, where he takes a moment to kind of deconstruct his influences on this very rich series with a lot of material that actually feeds into this cool sort of synthesis between turn-of-the-century horror in the style of H.P. Lovecraft, later spy thrillers from the 60s and 70s, and a very hackish sensibility. I especially like Into the Fear Factory, which was in the afterword of the Atrocity Archives, where he really delves into this notion of the hacker archetype as a protagonist. This piece up on his website continues in that same vein, though it's not a criticism of his own work. It's delivered in his usual idiom with wit and a dollop of sarcasm, and actually, it turns out, was inspired by an explanation by Ron Moore around the writing process for Star Trek The Next Generation. Moore apparently was a writer in the later days of that show before he went on to launch his Battlestar Galactica reboot, which he's much more well known for. He describes a formula used in the various Star Trek series late in their production where the writers would just insert the word tech into the dialogue, and Charlie's got some very humorous examples of what he means by that. The science and technology advisors would then go in and fill in reasonably sounding terms to replace that placeholder. But the use of that blank in the dialogue, if you will, demonstrates the writing had no real strong connection to the science part of the genre science fiction. I cannot say I disagree with this point entirely in this piece, though I do think he tars some later shows that are not as guilty as The Next Generation was of the problems that he describes. I'd also excuse many of these shows for not being as narratively and intellectually engaging, where I personally find them merely entertaining. On second reading of the piece, though, it turns out that the enjoyment for entertainment factor is kind of orthogonal to the point that he's driving at here. He seems to be suggesting that it would be better if these shows were not, in fact, science fiction, that they be just straight-up dramas. His complaint hinges on the notion that the point of science fiction is indeed the imagined situation, that futuristic realm in which the characters are embedded, and how they interact with it to understand predictions about the human circumstance in the future. He contends it is exactly that, when well executed, that makes science fiction distinct from other genres in how it approaches illuminating the very question of what it means to be human, different from those other genres and styles. And if these questions, especially in the context of literary criticism, are of interest to you at all, I highly suggest and encourage you to read this piece for yourself. The next story is that researchers may have uncovered what may ultimately be a limit on the speed of computation and on Moore's law itself, the notion that transistor density doubling every 12 to 18 months will drive the speed of computation to double along that same scale. This is based on research from Boston University of Massachusetts by Lev Levitin and Tommaso Toffoli. Levitin already had done some work looking at the most elemental operation possible for a quantum computer, so the smallest unit of computation. The pair then, in this latest research, apparently calculated the fastest time that that operation could be performed and arrived at a figure roughly 10 quadrillion more operations per second per unit of energy than the fastest of today's computers. That's a 10 to the 16th, I believe, faster than today's processors. They are claiming that this is a fundamental limit of the speed of computation, like the speed of light in a vacuum, that it just there's no way physically to exceed this. It doesn't depend, as the article notes, on the algorithms or physical means of computing. And the article that Slashdot links to spends some time on the predictions of when we'll reach this limit based on that progression, that acceleration curve predicted by Moore's law. And it ranges from an optimistic 75 to 80 years to a more pessimistic 20 years until we hit other limits that prevent us from getting anywhere near this ultimate limit of the speed of computation. The article also notes that this is based on a quantum computer, which is assumed to be the most efficient type of computer, and it is, being a universal computer, can emulate all other operations of all other kinds of universal computers, so it's a fairly valid comparison, I suppose. There is a douse of cold water when you realize that we are barely taking baby steps towards practical quantum computers. It's a trend and stories that I cover very closely, as longtime listeners know on this show, about the incremental steps we're making towards having quantum computers that we would someday have access to as consumers or power users. I do wonder if the research takes parallelism into account. It's one of the ways that we're working around some of the limitations in the physical systems we use for computing today. We're doing so by including more processing cores into a single computer system. And I wonder if including more quantum cores would allow us to effectively, even though any particular core couldn't execute faster than this computed limit, this calculated limit, if an overall quantum computing system with multiple cores could actually bypass it. Today, it adds complexity in how software coordinates its work across those multiple cores. I can only imagine in quantum computing environment had just how much more complex that approach of parallel processing would become. But as I said, it does work around the limits of scale inherent in today's physical computing architecture. And I have to imagine that Levitin's and Toffoli's work takes in some parallelization. I mean, one of the reasons that quantum computers are so attractive and why people are pursuing them so aggressively is they are believed to be inherently parallel, this based on their ability to represent multiple states of information that a quantum bit or a qubit can simultaneously represent 0 and 1, as opposed to a discrete computer today that can represent either or at any time, but not any gradation in between. I think the limit here may be applied to components more fundamental than what we're used to thinking about, to individual elements at the scale of a transistor per se, rather than the overall system. So it's possible in practice that the comparisons they're making to desktop computers or supercomputers aren't entirely fair, that we need to dial this comparison in what's ultimately some popular coverage of some very heavy math and physics research. There may be room for other techniques and parallelism and things beyond that to flesh out what the ultimate fastest computing system we could come up with based on this low-level fundamental work. We're not used to thinking about what happens per clock tick on a CPU die, that there are any number of elements on there. Regardless, I think it's valuable to know that this limit exists in some form, even if there's some complexity in how it may ultimately affect future computers. Hopefully, it would inspire future system designers to try to better compensate as they start to approach this proposed upper bound. This last piece actually kind of dovetails with the first piece. It's an announcement by Carl Malamud on O'Reilly's Radar site of some work that his organization, publicresource.org, is undertaking in collaboration with other groups to set up a repository or propose a means, a procedure, and tools for establishing a repository of the text of the laws of the United States. Malamud and others have been tasked with a recommendation, deriving a recommendation and plans for a site which I guess will be called law.gov. This would be, as I said, a repository of legislative materials to be published by the government. This is actually a goal that Carl and his foundation have been working on for a while. And in the post on Radar, Carl cites the smaller successes that he's achieved along the way as gaining some traction, as paving the way for this much more ambitious undertaking. He also credits O'Reilly's Gov 2.0 conference, where he was given a forum to advance the idea and ask for help. He even mentions that at that very same conference, the deputy CTO of the U.S. acknowledged that opening these legislative texts should be a goal of the administration, one that they should use all the resources at their disposal to support. The process, not surprisingly, will be held in the open, I guess for the public to comment, potentially even contribute. It is clearly going to give preference to open source tools, judging by Carl's remarks in the article, above and beyond the open access of the resulting material itself. He goes on to outline some of the challenges, in particular on the technical side, the need for very specific enhancements in addition to existing open source tools like Tesseract, which is an OCR system. They need some additional capabilities on top of that, and a challenge for librarians as well to prioritize what the repository ultimately should include. I am optimistic that even if the full proposal is not adopted and implemented by the government, that this will continue to inspire more successes in opening access. I'd guess that by also opening the process itself of developing the recommendation and plans, it may also inspire more of this sort of public-private partnering, rather than asking the government to wholly shoulder the burden of planning as well as implementing these sorts of systems, and run the risk of kind of sinking under the weight of the challenge of doing so. Best of luck to Carl and publicresource.org, as well as the other participants who hopefully will come up with a very realizable plan moving forward for this very ambitious goal. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've talked about before, and I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. The only follow-up I have this week is on the sordid story of the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. This is one that's most controversial for taking place largely behind closed doors, that nobody in the public has had very much insight outside of a few leaked draft documents about what will actually make up this agreement. There's a suspected to be some intellectual property enforcement, trying to normalize that across participants in the agreement when it's ready for signing. Nate Anderson at Ars Technica has a great update on this about not only how the negotiations are planned to get underway next month, but also that some folks actually have managed to get access to this, that under a carefully crafted non-disclosure agreement. Knowledge Ecology International has actually been investigating ACTA, trying to crack loose some of this privacy, and actually got a list of the 42 people privy to the actual drafts themselves. They had to do so under a Freedom of Information Act request. The government didn't want to give up that list, citing state security issues, national security issues. The Ars article includes the full list and their associations, and the list surprisingly includes some consumer-friendly representatives. There's some folks from Public Knowledge and the Center for Democracy and Technology. Anderson also points out that Bill Patry is on the list, a copyright lawyer from Google, who has been very critical of the practices of big content. Michael Petricone is on the list, who is often on the opposing side from big content at a lot of conferences speaking. And Jonathan Band, a DC lawyer who has represented the interests of libraries in many copyright cases. Many of the corporations represented as well are not necessarily fans of intellectual property enforcement either. KEI notes, though, that the consumer interest here, the public interest, is being proxied largely through corporations. Outside of Public Knowledge and CDT, there's no real direct public representation in these NDA signees. Anderson also points out that one of the big content heavyweights is on the list, Steve Metelitz, who Ars has covered in the past, most notoriously for his comments defending onerous DRM schemes when a service goes dark, ultimately taking down its key servers and depriving customers who paid for digital goods access to those works. The article concludes that when negotiations resume next month, they will still be pushing for online enforcement as part of the agreement. And that's outside of that secrecy of the negotiations is probably the most hotly contended issue on the list of things the agreement's looking to address. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoy the program, please go to the website at thecommandline.net, make a donation, purchase some swag, or at the very least, tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, you can call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Wednesday night, will include my interview with Pearl and Small Talk hacker Randall Schwartz. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Libsyn and WahoDB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permissions to use those are granted under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial ShareAlike Version 3.0 United States License.